Die Presse. Auf ein neues zum Jahreswechsel. Hallo Thomas.
Servus Martina.
Wir blicken jetzt nicht zurück auf 2025, oder?
Puh, na, bitte nicht, was für ein Jahr es war.
Okay, zunächst also ein Hallo auch an unsere Zuhörerinnen und Zuhörer. Herzlich willkommen zu unserem Podcast East Side Stories. Wir sind Martina Czarnowska
und Thomas Seifert.
Im chinesischen Kalender ist 2026 das Jahr des Feuerpferdes, das für Tempo und Wandel steht, aber auch zu Übertreibungen neigen kann.
Martina, du glaubst an Horoskope?
Nicht wirklich. Aber ich unterschätze nicht die Kraft von Symbolen. Ebenso wenig wie die Dynamik und Rolle Chinas, mit dem sich ja die USA zum Beispiel im Wettkampf sehen.
Ja, und das ist ganz interessant, weil in der jüngst veröffentlichten nationalen Sicherheitsstrategie wird zum Beispiel Russland nicht primär als akute Bedrohung für die Weltordnung geframed, sondern als Macht, mit der man strategische Stabilität sucht. Und das Ziel ist nicht mehr die Zurückdrängung Putins oder der Sieg der Ukraine, sondern ein dealbasierter Frieden, um einfach den Rücken frei zu haben. Aber interessanterweise, und jetzt komme ich wieder zu China, auch China wird entideologisiert. Es ist kein systemischer Rivale mehr nach diesem Papier im moralischen Sinn, sondern einfach nur ein harter wirtschaftlicher Wettbewerber. Die Botschaft an Peking und Moskau ist also klar, macht zu Hause, was ihr wollt, solange ihr unsere Wirtschaft nicht ruiniert und euch aus unserer westlichen Hemisphäre heraushaltet.
Die USA ziehen sich also auf die Festung Amerika zurück und sehen im alten Verbündeten Europa plötzlich das Problem, während die Autokraten zu pragmatischen Verhandlungspartnern werden. Doch bei allem Lamentieren darüber müssen wir Europäer diese geopolitische Realität hinnehmen und noch besser mitgestalten, auch wenn wir eingequetscht zwischen den Machtblöcken erscheinen. Wobei es da noch immer zumindest ein verbindendes Element gibt, die NATO. Und wie wichtig das etwa in osteuropäischen Ländern ist, macht unsere heutige Sprachnachricht deutlich.
Genau, und sie kommt von Erika Fuchs. Sie ist die Chefredakteurin von tv3.lt.
Stationiert in Vilnius, der Hauptstadt von Litauen, das ja an Weißrussland und die russische Exklave Kaliningrad grenzt. Klar, dass in den baltischen Staaten angesichts der russischen Aggression der NATO-Schutzschirm besondere Bedeutung hat. Aber lassen wir Erika Fuchs zu Wort kommen.
Voice message. WhatsApp Vilnius.
Labadiena, I am Erika Fuchs, editor-in-chief of news webpage tv3.lt. And in Vilnius, we are now currently talking about the defense issues and we have drones. We have seen that the work of airport was stopped. And of course, people are worried, but we are really happy having a German brigade and we have German military personnel in Vilnius. So that gives us a security and a sense of belonging to NATO because we see troops on the ground and that is very important due to those really hard and dangerous times because Vilnius and Lithuania all the Baltics have been a part of Soviet Union and we never want to see that again happening. So people are preparing and of course the Lithuanian citizens, they are joining all the organizations where they can prepare if the aggressor comes.
Und das war Erika Fuchs aus Vilnius. Sie erzählte, dass es in Litauen jetzt auch freiwillige Organisationen gibt, denen Bürgerinnen und Bürger beitreten können und die können sich dort entweder für einen möglichen Kampf vorbereiten oder sie können sich ausbilden lassen, wie sie als Zivilisten das Militär unterstützen können.
Ah, das ist so ähnlich wie in Finnland. Und nun zu etwas ganz anderem. Reden wir kurz über eine der wichtigsten Wahlen im Jahr 2026.
Nämlich
das Parlamentsvotum in Ungarn, das im April stattfinden soll. Herausforderer Peter Magyar rechnet sich Chancen aus, gegen Viktor Orbáns Fidesz siegen zu können.
Naja, und ein Machtwechsel in Ungarn, der könnte den Zusammenhalt in Europa durchaus stärken. Warum? Viktor Orbán macht sich in Brüssel ja immer wieder als Störfaktor recht unbeliebt.
Zu einem Thema, dem Thema EU-Erweiterung zumindest, hat die ungarische Regierung allerdings eine differenziertere Haltung. Ja zum Westbalkan und nein zur Ukraine.
Und die EU-Erweiterung war übrigens auch eines der Themen, über die ich beim Time to Decide Summit der ersten Stiftung mit Lea Ippi gesprochen habe. Die aus Albanien stammende Politikwissenschaftlerin, die an der renommierten London School of Economics lehrt, ist hierzulande nicht zuletzt als gefeierte Autorin bekannt. Der Titel ihres vor kurzem erschienenen Buchs lautet Aufrecht – Überleben im Zeitalter der Extreme. Auf die Frage nach der Bedeutung der EU-Erweiterung für die Union antwortete sie:
It's clear that Europe is making an effort to extend the enlargement, to develop the enlargement process. And for a very simple reason, that Europe outside, it can project itself as the coherent unitary actor that it is not if seen from within. So Europe seen from the outside is one thing, it's coherent, it has values, it presents itself as an actor with a certain standing in world politics. And if you look at Europe from within, it's an agent in crisis to the extent that there is an agent even, because it's actually 27 member states, each of which pursues their domestic politics. And this has an impact in how to think about European Union as a project that continues to develop. So what the enlargement process does, it's at the symbolic level, it offers Europe a way of seeing itself as one when it's not one. And this only lasts for as long as the enlargement process is not completed. And it's the same thing from Albanian perspective. From the Albanian perspective, what Europe gives, it's a kind of myth of belonging to a shared political and economic space in which we are promised that there will be freedom and opportunity. Of course, we know from the experience of other actors and the enlargement process, the way it has operated in other former communist countries that are now member states, that after this moment of romantic love with the EU comes a moment of disillusionment where we realize that actually Europe cannot solve the crisis of either capitalism or nation state, and therefore something else needs to be thought of. But in this moment of interim, in this interregnum, this is the one case, the enlargement process, and the fact that there are countries still there willing to integrate, believing in this narrative of the EU, it gives something very reassuring both to European Union countries and to the European Union project and to the candidate countries, because it gives them a kind of myth of future that they believe will eventually materialize and bring all the benefits that they've been hoping for.
But then our conversation took a turn to the hot topic of strongman politics.
I would say it's more of an ideological question than a strongman question. There is a vision of politics that is an ethno-nationalist, authoritarian, socially conservative, anti-progressive vision of politics that has gained legitimacy in the last few years, especially after the 2008 financial crisis. And that has been the case in Britain, in the United States, in a number of European Union countries, but also in places like India, Brazil. And so we have seen this vision of politics unfortunately manage to gather consent with citizens, in part, I think, as a result of the crisis of globalization and the failure of progressive actors to come up with an alternative to globalization that would not be authoritarian social conservatism. And so the critique of the status quo has been left to right-wing actors with a different hierarchy of values. And since the critique was needed, because for many people this crisis of globalization was a felt crisis, the fact that elites were bailed out and people lost jobs and were disenfranchised and vulnerable people had to bear the cost of the financial crisis meant that there was resentment towards the elites, and the right were the only actors that could capitalize on this resentment and this anti-elite hostility and drive forward an alternative project that is not one that perhaps liberal progressives would like, but it's a coherent alternative to the status quo.
This is what Leah Ippi had to say about the new vision for politics.
For me, the interesting question is, when we think about visions of politics, is to engage with a critique of the status quo and not find false reassurance and be complacent about what actually works, but think, yes, of course, we know that at one level commercial development works, but we also know that it doesn't work for everyone in the same way. And so what can we do to improve? What can we do to, for example, when we're asking this question at the European level, what can we do to make sure that we control the market rather than the market controlling us? And these are all viable ways of thinking about the future of the European project.
Europe tried different economic models, but what model does Leah Ippi suggest?
Yeah, I think there is a critique of state socialism, and there is also a critique of social democracy when it's just wedded to the nation state. And both of these, both social democracy and state socialism, stem from an anti-capitalist tradition, which I think is worth recovering, because what we have lost is a critique of capitalism, a critique of the markets, and a critique of and a vision of social justice that delivers for everyone. And we also need a reckoning with these double failures. On the one hand, state socialism, so the Eastern European version, but on the other hand, also the fact that we know where Thatcher and Reagan came from. They also came from a crisis of social democracy, and from the difficulty of developing social democracy in combination just with the nation state and the need to have a larger territorial unit and a larger institutional arrangement that could actually accommodate and develop an alternative account, both political, institutional and economic, to capitalism. So what can we learn? I think we can engage with those two failures without thinking that, you know, the social democracy of the 20th century was the final ideal on which we all settled, because we know why that didn't fail to why also that failed. And it failed because it wasn't backed up by international institutions that could make social democracy robust, because we had a global market that was unbridled. And therefore, in those circumstances, in circumstances of global market competition, the social democratic project, when it was limited just to isolated nation state, was struggling. So what we can learn from that is, I think, to develop a transnational theory and a transnational account of how to come up with a critique of market capitalism and also with a critique of state socialism and a different driver for a project of international institutions like the European Union, for example.
And one could argue that in terms of idea exporting ideas and ideologies, Europe is strong because, as I said, if you talk to any, you know, communist leader in China, they have read the Marx for sure. At least in the Party Academy, this was on their reading list. Fascism was exported all the way to Chile. So I'm wondering, do you have a feeling that Europe could do this again, in the sense that coming up with ideas, and there was a dialogue with China, for instance, trying to get their, let's say, socialist, state socialism more in a more European, let's say, social democratic way. Is there a chance also for exporting ideas?
Well, so I am actually a little bit reluctant usually to define ideas as European, because I don't think ideas have territory. Ideologies, they're universal, they're answers to problems. And I think fascism is as much European, as you said, as socialism is European, as Nazism is European. And so Europe has been the birthplace of terrible things as well as excellent things. And so I don't think there's anything European about European values. I think values are values. And of course, in particular contingent institutional moments and political moments, those values take over because of the particular history of Europe. So I think we can learn from the history of Europe. We can learn from this European project that emerged from the ashes of World War II and was fundamentally a project of peace, was fundamentally a project of overcoming nation-state divisions, of overcoming nationalism. And I think in its inception, although this is a little bit more debatable, was also a project of controlling markets with certain social imperatives. And in that sense, I think that is a plausible project. There's a plausible critique of capitalism can emerge from there, but it needs to be a political project. It can't just be a set of policies, because Europe can't just run on policies. It needs to regenerate itself, and we need to have a sense of what we stand for when we defend the European Union, what kind of model of the European Union we stand for. And I don't think we can just defend the institutions that we have. We can just have the status quo. I remember I did my PhD thesis in Florence at the European University Institute in the mid-2000s, when there was a lot of discussion around the constitutional treaty, around reforming the treaties, reforming the European Union, coming up with a sense of we the people of Europe. And, of course, that whole debate was in many ways still very much an academic debate. It never made it into the broader public. But it's exactly the kind of renewal that Europe needed to become also the Europe of the peoples and not just the Europe of Brussels elites. And we need to start with the criticism, not be defensive about that, about the shortcomings and the failures of that project, and then begin with re-engaging and trying to offer an alternative.
I'm now citing Steve Bannon, which is interesting, but the guy has at least one sentence that I find very interesting and very true, and he says, politics is downstream from culture. So if that is correct, and we need, you're talking about not such as the vibe shift, you're talking about a huge shift, that it means it probably will start with culture first. So where do you see that? I mean, do you see anything on the horizon where you see a shift or potential for a shift? Maybe generational, maybe Gen X is our generation, okay, forget us. But there's Gen Z, of course, they're much more interconnected and so on. But I see them buying a lot of stuff just because they see a trend on the web. So where do you see kind of these, let's say, cultural signals that, yeah, this is something that you can, where you can put some hope, draw some hope from?
I mean, I think I would start by challenging the premise of Steve Bannon, actually, this idea that politics is downstream from culture, and that to me reinforces a narrative of the world and diagnosis of political and economic conflicts that is exactly what the right wants to convince us, that every conflict that we experience is a conflict that is ultimately conducive to culture. I don't believe that. I think culture can be downstream from politics as well, and indeed, even the very thing that most national conservatives hold on to, this idea of the nation as, you know, the fundamental organic unit where everything ends. We know from history that that is also artificial, that's politically constructed, that nationalism is something that emerged at a particular point in time in response to the aristocracy or to the old regime, and as in part connected to this demand for democratizing and for including other people. So I think, or including the masses to this politics that was very much a politics of the elites as it was in the 19th century. So I don't think there is anything natural about nationalism. I don't think there's anything natural about culture. I think there are political projects that, when they become hegemonic, convince us that this is how the world has always been. And because of that, it's always important to remember that there can be an alternative politics and there can be an alternative construction, analysis of the world, an alternative diagnosis of the problems, and an alternative solution to the one that is on offer from the right.
What is your leadership style? And I studied biology, so I have to apologize to the gorillas what I just saying. But basically, you can lead in two ways. You say, okay, I have the silverback here in this jungle. I have a stick. I'm the strongest guy here. So, and everybody, by the way, is an enemy out there. As you know, you get killed easily. So follow me. Or there is another principle, that's a Moses, who says, okay, this slavery really sucks in Egypt. Come on, guys, I have the promised land. Follow me. If need to be, God will help us, maybe even parting the seas. Just follow me. I have a dream, right? And it seems to be that this also switches sometimes. Sometimes the dreamy people are in fashion. I mean, Václav Havel, who would have thought he'd become the leader of the Czechoslovakia right from jail? Nelson Mandela was such a person. And it seems to be, where are they? All I see is these gorillas. And again, please apologize, gorillas, because you're lovely animals. But yeah, Donald Trump, Xi Jinping, Putin, even Modi, Erdogan. I mean, the list is really long. So what happened?
I think there is an incentive in our society and our politics to reduce the problems, the contributions of individuals. And I think it's fundamentally a pre-modern way of thinking about politics. So leadership, politics as leadership, is Machiavelli. And this is not how democracy works. Democracy is led by collective agents. In fact, Gramsci, when he was studying Machiavelli, he spoke of the political party as a modern prince. Why? Because a party is a collective. It's a collective agent. It's not something that can be reducible to just one individual. And the party is a group of people who takes responsibility based on a vision of how they want society to change. Now, of course, when we live in a time, as we do, of complete impoverishment of representative politics, of a crisis of democracy, where parties are just reduced to being at the mercy of donors, where they act they respond and they relate to citizens as though they were business consumers, when they make decisions based on focus groups, as they do in marketing campaigns and advertising campaigns, there is very little left to this idea of the party as a collective agent that gets regenerated from ideas, that has a critique of society that drives this critique forward. And then what we're left with is basically a party that is reduced to the leader and to the then discussions around the charismatic personality. And so we end up talking about, you know, is this politician good looking? Does he speak well?
Of course, this also plays a role here, right?
But that's just a tool.
Mobile
phone is just a tool. A tool is a tool. A tool doesn't have reason. Reason is given to the tool by the agents that use the tool. So I think that this reduction of politics to the contribution of individuals and individual leaders, it's something that's very convenient in a society where axes of injustice are produced by collective forces, and often anonymous and impersonal ones, where you have capitalism that is responsible for a lot of the inequalities and the injustices that we experience. But then, of course, that system needs to blame it on particular individuals so that we don't take responsibility for the system, and we can actually just park the discussion around what kind of system are we living in. So I would say that, yes, leadership is very important. And I don't want to dispute that, of course, there is a contingent subjective element that some leaders can be better carriers of ideas than others. But I would say that the work is actually done from the ideas. And it really pains me to say it. I do think that the right has ideas about how to change the world and how to change politics. They are not my ideas. I don't like them. But it is a very coherent vision of the world. And we better engage and understand that before we can then start blaming the particular politicians like Trump and Meloni and so on.
But okay, now at least it seems to me that it's getting clearer what basically who is the puppet master, who is the person who moves the figures on the chessboard, like Peter Thiel or other oligarchs, right? But again, and you're right, you just, you know, what made me think that, of course, we see this network politics when we talk about the Gen Z protests on the African continent, or even in Serbia or other places where we had this. But still, it seems to me that, okay, the left in general, or the progressives, enlightened people, liberals, whatever we want to call them, so let's say the sane people, they don't have these ideas that are, or at least they are perceived, I think, by the masses to say, okay, you just want the status quo plus a little bit more humanism plus a little bit more equality and so on, but that's it, right?
Yeah, but because the left doesn't have a political answer to the crisis of the status quo. The left, the political answer is one that says, this is my friend, this is my enemy. That's what politics is friend, enemy. The left doesn't have an answer to who is your adversary. And as you mentioned, it's very clear what are the adversary here is the tech oligarchs, the people who have a lot of money, the inheritance rules that we have, the fundamental contradictions of politics that is driven by markets. The left doesn't have the courage to stand up for this because it depends on donors, it depends on oligarchs, it depends on capital to run its course. And so this is where it needs to really convince people that it's taking seriously the critique of the status quo before and the response and the alternative before they can actually switch. So I don't think people are siding with the right because they're ignorant or inherently racist or stupid. It's because they have certain dissatisfactions from the status quo that the right responds to. And it also has a diagnosis of the conflict that blames it on someone. So it has an answer to the who, whom, and the question of who is my friend, who is my enemy. Again, I don't like that answer, but it is an answer, and it's not one that progressives have yet.
Hmm. So what would the answer be?
Well, we just said, I mean, the Mamdani campaign is a very good example, right? So why was the Mamdani campaign successful in New York? Because it was saying, look, don't worry about identity, don't worry about membership, think about the cost of living, think about the your daily life, think about how you could improve that with certain responses that are political responses, but also need to explain where is the sacrifice going to come from. And so if we don't tackle oligarchy, if we don't tackle the owners of capital, if we don't tackle the kind of economic system that is running behind all of this, then we won't be able to have a political answer. We will only have moral proposals.
Die Politologin Lea Ippi möchte also nicht von europäischen Werten sprechen, weil Werte universell sind. Könnte das ebenso ein verbindendes Element sein? Den Link zum Gespräch mit Lea Ippi finden Sie jedenfalls in den Shownotes.
Ebenso Informationen zur aktuellen Ausgabe der European Voices.
Das war Kapitel 10 der East Side Stories.
Schön, dass Sie dabei waren.
Hören Sie uns wieder.
Und zum Abschied, frohes neues Jahr.
Szczęśliwego nowego roku.